Beautiful but Deadly.
Or The Beauty of Makeup.
Meets a Horror of True Crime. With Chuck.
And Liz.
You forget. Every time.
Oh my god.
I don't know why. I expected you to say with, but not the Chuck part. I was like, waiting for the with.
Oh my god.
Okay, so let's just jump right into it because I'm excited. All right. Trigger warnings. Murder, dismemberment, domestic abuse, abortion, animal abuse, and mob mentions. Galveston, Texas, September 2001. A kid came across a torso by the seaside while fishing. Just a torso.
Well, we're really jumping right in.
Yep. Detective Gary Jones was called to the scene and had to get the body out of the water. He said that he had to put his hand down the body's throat and hook his odd hand around the sternum to get it out of the
water.
Did
he have to? Because that sounds like something he didn't have to do.
What else was he going to grab onto?
Why is the detective doing it? Where's the coroner? Aren't you supposed to just leave it there?
Well, what if it washes away?
Not for Detective Gary Jones. I'm sorry, but that's such a detective name.
Right?
Detective Gary Jones.
Ow. Oh. What was so hard? God. Did you get pig lights? Okay. They also found a bunch of black plastic trash bags floating around.
Oh, no.
The bags held arms, legs, hands, etc.
I had a feeling.
There was also one bag that was empty, but it looked like it had been sliced open by, like, a knife, not by a rock or anything.
Oh, okay.
They determined that the dismemberment started with the right leg, then the left arm, then the neck, then the right arm.
Do you know how they determined that?
Probably by the blood flow and everything.
Okay.
You know.
Oh.
The right arm was only partially sawed through before it was broken off, probably by stepping on it. The head was not found. The head searched all over and it was never found. To this day, it has never been found.
Really?
Yep. They found a newspaper by the body, like, in one of the trash bags,
mm-hmm.
and there was an address on the newspaper that read 2212 Avenue K. So they go there, and it's a house, but inside the house, it's separated into apartments, like, it's rented out.
Okay.
There was blood on the stair rail, and it trailed into the road.
So let me ask you. You said there was a trash bag that was, like, cut open. Is it possible the head was in there, and then the head floated away?
I guess we'll see.
Okay.
So a man by the last name of Dillman owned the house, but an older man named Morris Black was renting a part of the downstairs, which was apartment one, and the other section was apartment two, which was owned by an old lady, Dorothy Siner, who was also mute and deaf. Dillman said he liked her as a tenant, but never really saw her. He also said that she had paid a year in advance on her rent.
Well, she got that shmoney, huh?
Apparently, she also traveled all of the time, so no one really saw her. They ended up identifying the body that had washed up as Morris Black using fingerprints on one hand. There was also blood going into apartment two, which got them a search warrant into that apartment. It was a neat apartment, but on the floor of the kitchen had drop cloths, and under the cloths were small cuts into the floor. It was like a vinyl floor. They ended up cutting up the floor, and underneath they found blood,
ooh,
which was Morris's.
I was going to ask about that.
That is where he was dismembered. The investigators were sus of Dorothy's story. Because, like, if she could travel all the time, why was she living in this tiny apartment?
Like, what do you mean?
Like, the house was maybe half the size of the our downstairs where they were living. And they split that in half, like, two apartments.
Oh.
It was small. Dillman had seen her. So, like, we know this is, like, a real person.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't many personal items in the apartment, and they said that there was nothing there to show that, like, a woman lived there.
My first thought is she's a spy. Bum, bum, bum.
She's an old lady.
Old lady spy. Bum, bum, bum.
Never expected. Dillman said that sometimes he saw a man who he believed to be her brother or brother-in-law with her. They go through the trash from behind the building, and there was an appointment receipt, which showed that some glasses had to be picked up, and this receipt was for a man named Robert Durst. The people at the eye place said that he was supposed to pick them up on Friday, but didn't. So, the police expect he will end up showing there up there at some point to get his glasses, so the investigator gives them his card and his beeper number. What?
Durst. That last name sounds familiar.
Isn't that guy from the band? Fred Durst? Is that his name?
I have no idea. I thought there was a serial killer, Durst. I could be wrong.
Fred Durst? Is that his name? It was Ed Durst. That's in that band.
Which band? Or do you not remember the band?
Limp Bizkit.
Ah, okay.
The investigator that gave his card is Detective Cody Cazalas.
Cazalas.
They also found a price tag from a hardware store. Bozaw, the drop cloths, and a 4-inch knife was bought there. Cazalas gets a message to his pager and he rushes to the clinic. And actually, on his way to the clinic, he was almost there. Robert Durst pulls out right in front of him. Like, not like in a aggressive way or anything. Oh, just happened, like, he pulled out.
Yeah.
So Cazalas ends up following him and ends up right behind him at a red light. Pulls him over and they detain him. Jones, Gary Jones, you know, the detective, saw through the back windshield that Durst had a bow saw.
Oh, well.
So Cazalas is talking to him when they take him into custody about, like, why he's there and that his bond is set at $25,000.
Okay, it's not very much.
Durst goes, what do I do? And Cazalas says, well, do you have $25,000? Well, not on me.
I mean, who would have it on them?
Who just has $25,000 hanging around?
People who are good with their money.
Do you have $25,000?
No, God, no.
I don't know anyone that would. I don't know anyone that would. Juan and Jelly ended up calling a woman named Deborah from New York. And Deborah says that he can get her the money by morning. Deborah ends up being Deborah Lee Sheraton, Robert's current wife. She married on December 11th, 2000. She had found out he had rented an apartment in Texas only after he called her from prison. And he got out in like 24 hours.
So she didn't even know that he had an apartment?
No.
Rip.
The next morning, Cazalas comes into work and he has 21 messages. And through those messages, that's when he finds out who Robert Durst is. He belongs to one of the richest families in NYC. Oh, and he's suspected of it being his former wife's murderer. His organization had 9 buildings, with one of them being in Times Square, like his family business.
So that's how he has money.
Mm-hmm. His wife's name is Kathleen Durst, and she was reported missing in 1982. She was never found. And her family thought that Robert was responsible as well as many other people. We'll talk about why. His arraignment comes, and he was supposed to be there at 10 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't show up.
Of course he didn't.
So he was on the run, and even his lawyer begged him to come home and turn himself in. Like, no one knew where he was.
That's what we call a flight risk.
All right, so let's go back to Dorothy, a.k.a. Dottie. Dillman had described her as flat-chested and ugly, which...
Damn, that's brutally honest.
Which would make sense the more this investigation went on. Okay. Robert would use her name as an alias and was known to dress as a woman.
Oh.
Dorothy was a real person he went to school with, but she was not the person living in that apartment.
It was him? Yeah. Oh my God.
He had also used Morris's name at a car rental place in Mobile, Alabama. And those were just 2 names among many that he used. Many aliases.
I'm shook. Like, did he always use women as aliases or no?
No.
Okay.
Like I said, he used Morris's name before.
Oh, okay.
So, Durst was eventually arrested at a grocery store in Hanover Township, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. After, guess what he was arrested for? How he got caught?
What?
He tried to steal a hoagie.
Oh my fucking God. This man has $25,000 just laying around and he has to steal a hoagie. Come on.
He had shaved his head and was now wearing glasses. He looked like Heisenberg, but.
Oh my God.
They searched his rental car and found weed, $38,000 in cash, 2 loaded guns, and Morris Black's ID.
38 grand, but steals a fucking sandwich. Are you kidding me?
Some people think he was trying to get arrested, and others think he was just getting through life without consequence, so he became reckless.
Okay.
He talks about it later. He was in Pennsylvania for 2 months where he was in jail before being turned over to Texas, where Morris was killed. In the 90s, Durst had left the family business. His brother says one day he just stopped showing up and he never knew why. Oh. It seems like it was because his brother was picked to run it, and even though Robert was older.
I mean, Robert seems like a fuck-up, so I don't blame him.
And when Robert had, like, run from his arraignment, his brother had hired a bodyguard. So during one of his jail interviews, like with a detective, he was asked, why do you think your brother Douglas hired this bodyguard? And Robert said, and I quote, he was a pussy. That's why he hired the bodyguard.
Okay.
And he doesn't know why his brother would be afraid of him. But it comes out later that while he was on the run, he pulled into Douglas' driveway with two guns. Also, he made a threat against his life at one point. But that's okay.
Oh, no,
we'll
fine.
Get to that.
Oh, my God.
So, Deborah hated his lawyer, his first lawyer, Michael Kennedy.
Okay.
Kennedy was hired by the Durst business, and she believed that he was loyal to Douglas first.
Is he, like, a Kennedy, or does he just happen to have the last name?
I think he just happens to have the last name. Okay. Like, who
knows at this point?
So, Robert wanted this guy named DeGaron. Dick DeGaron is a criminal defense attorney and had been practicing law since 1965.
Okay.
But Debbie wanted another lawyer named Ramsey, so they ended up hiring both. These are the, like, best lawyers you can get.
Okay.
They must have spent millions just on the lawyers.
Jesus.
So, like I said before, he was suspected of murdering his wife.
Yes. Kathleen. His first wife, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Who was Kathleen? She's beautiful and smart, and her mom still thinks that Robert has the key to her disappearance. Because technically, they haven't found her body. They don't know she's murdered. But she has never been found.
I mean, I think we know.
Robert says that she was a people person. She's outgoing and good with people, which balanced him out since he wasn't really social. He was kind of cold and awkward.
Interesting. Sounds like a psychopath to me.
Or just like an autistic person. Damn. Damn, Liz.
We know what he did.
We do?
I mean, he murdered his first wife and dismembered a man. I'm pretty sure
allegedly,
about that.
Allegedly, we haven't gotten 10 convictions
yet.
Allegedly.
I'm pretty sure about that.
After only two dates, they moved in together in Vermont in January 1972. Two dates.
Are you sure about that? Maybe I think that.
In March, they began talking about marriage, but they waited until April 12th, 1973.
Oh, good God.
Her mom says Robert was odd and never really friendly. It seems like he just couldn't mesh with the average American family, and he wouldn't partake in their conversations.
But he just wouldn't say anything?
Maybe. He wouldn't really converse with them, like, when they were talking. Yes. He says looking back, he feels bad about how he treated Kathleen's mom. One of the last people besides Robert to see Kathy was Geraldine, who was a family friend. McInerney? He was a family friend. As soon as the two entered Kathleen's home, she phoned Bob, and Geraldine goes, do you always phone him? And Kathleen says, yes, he always wants to know where I am. They were talking about a trip that she was taking the next day to South Salem, where she was going to meet Bob there. And Kathleen said that she didn't want to go. Geraldine was like, just tell him that you don't want to go. And Kathleen looked at her and goes, are you kidding me? He'd kill me. That night at 3:30, so she ends up going to the cottage in South Salem. And that night at about 3:34, she called her friend, her best friend, Gilberta, and was like, I need to get out of here. So she went over to Gilberta's for dinner, and throughout the time she was there, she was getting calls from Robert and was shaken every time she answered the phone. And eventually she was told to come home.
That is what we call a red flag.
As she was leaving, she said to Gilberta, promise me if something happens, you'll check it out. I'm afraid of Bobby.
Jesus.
Oh, it's worth. It's worth. After that, Kathy disappeared. That night she was gone. Robert had been the one to call in the missing persons report and said that she hadn't been seen since Sunday the 31st, 1982.
Sure.
He said that they went to the grocery store, came home for breakfast, Kathy went to Gilberta's, and then she came home at around 7:30. And he said that she had been drinking but like wasn't drunk. They had a sandwich together, and then they left for Katona Station, which is a train station, at 8:30, and she got on a train. And then after that, he returned to the house. He says that his neighbor, when he arrived home, had invited him over for a drink. Then, after he had that drink, he went on a walk, called his wife from a payphone at about 11:15, and says that she was fine and watching TV. After that, he goes home and goes to sleep. Police made it to the apartment because the doorman said he saw her come in at about 11:30-ish. And that Monday, she called in sick to her college. That was the last time anyone spoke to her. She was 29 when she disappeared. After that, there was no more calls, no credit or debit card activity, nothing.
So that is what I'm hearing. So someone saw her come back to the house. The doorman.
To her apartment in New York. She went on the train and went to New York, and then she went to her apartment.
Okay.
Robert told the police that they had some marital difficulties. Kathy's brother said that she would never really talk about the negatives in their relationship to him. But in her diary, she once wrote that during the spring of 79, after a party, they had come home drunk, argued, and he slapped her. In fall of 79, he punched her after an argument while sober.
Oh my god.
She had also been wanting a divorce, and the Thursday before her disappearance, her attorney told her that Robert had turned down her request for an agreement on a divorce.
This is a whole lot of trouble to me.
After about 2 or 3 weeks, one of her friends was upset that like nothing was being done mm-hmm. by the police.
Fair.
So she and some other women went in and talked to Michael Strzok, the investigator on the case.
Okay.
And they would tell him about the violence, and one of the women would go to the meetings. One of the women that would go to the meetings was her friend Geraldine from earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that the police didn't seem to care at all. She expected them to be like, oh shit, there's domestic violence, like take notes or anything.
Yeah.
But they all seemed blasé about it. Strzok said that them coming in was redundant, and he goes, and I quote, as the case went forward, after a long time, a lot of these things became very redundant. In case something happens to me, you know, Bob did it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's usually what we call a red flag there, Chief.
He deadass said blah, blah, blah.
Oh my god.
About domestic abuse.
Like, I'm sorry, but generally speaking, when people are like, if something happens to me, it was this person. It's usually that person. It's because they have something to back it up. They're not just saying it.
So her friends started investigating themselves.
I hate when that shit has to happen. When it's like the friends or family have to investigate because the cops aren't doing their goddamn job.
But like her friends were badass. Gilberto went on the train and Kathy went on and was just asking people on the train if they saw Kathy and showing her photo.
Mm-hmm.
She also went to the hospital for 5 or 6 shifts and asked every nurse she could if Kathy was in there and would show them her photo. And they would even go to reservoirs and look for tire tracks. There was another friend, Ellen, who had become involved as well, and she started tracking everything they did. So, like, at this time, we did this, and blah, blah, blah.
Damn.
So, they even went through Robert's garbages.
Okay.
It was like a robbery. Ellen was in the car with the doors open and the car running, while Gilberta ran out and stole the garbage and put it in the car, and then they drove off. They would take the garbage into their house and pour it onto the floor and just go through it.
Interesting.
They found that he was throwing out her things, like her textbooks and her clothes. Why would you throw out a missing person's clothes?
Well, exactly.
And they found a paper with Bob's handwriting that just said, town, dump, bridge, dig, boat, other, shovel or ? Car, truck, rent.
Oh my god.
Strzok said about this, quote, what does that mean to me in February of 1982? What are you going to do with the shovel in February? And he just goes on about the shovel.
What?
He just wrote it off completely.
Okay, but the shovel isn't even, like, the worst part of it. It sounds to me like he's going through options of how he could dump her body,
mm-hmm.
throw it off a bridge, bury it, rent a truck and put it in it. Yeah, okay, sir. How did you become a cop? Because you're shit.
Bob also wasn't talking to Kathy's family at this point at all. So when her family went to New York, they got in touch with his dad, Seymour, who they kind of made him invite them over, you know, very nicely.
Hey, can I pop in?
While over, they started asking, like, do you know anything? And he was getting super defensive and said that they didn't see any warmth or empathy regarding his daughter-in-law. During this, another of Robert's brothers, Tom, came home and goes, what is this? They explain that they're talking about Kathy's disappearance, and Tom goes, this discussion is over. And they left.
That sounds a whole lot like somebody knows something.
Robert said about the relationship that he was the dominant one and he was the one making all the decisions, and she just went along with it until she kind of got sick of it and started becoming independent. He says that the change began when he, in his words, he said this, made her get an abortion. She wrote, in February 76, she had accidentally gotten pregnant. They had discussed before if this were to happen, she would get an abortion, but she changed her mind when she actually got pregnant.
Fair, that happens.
And he blamed her, saying that she was supposed to be in charge of that stuff, and said, well, if you keep the baby, you're getting divorced from me.
And that's what we say.
But saying that it's only her job to not get pregnant.
So stupid.
He said that he doesn't remember the first time he hit her, but he remembers other times, so he fessed up to the fact that he hit her. And he says that by 81, they were fighting all of the time. On January 6th, 1982, Kathy had called her friend Eleanor Schwenk and said that Robert hit her again, and Eleanor this time convinced her to go to the hospital so there would be evidence. So, the night that she disappeared, she had told him that he was taking the car and going to Gilberta's. Said that she was taking the car, and he was mad that she said that she was just taking the car instead of asking.
Oh my god.
And that she didn't immediately invite him. And that it was the weekend. She was leaving. And he was mad about that.
Eat my ass.
Whenever she gets home. And he says that she was angry at him. And that she announced that she wanted to go to the city. And he was like, fine, but you aren't taking the car.
Ugh.
And they argued over the car, and he even went in and took the keys out of the ignition. And during this, he said it became a pushing, shoving argument, and eventually agreed to take the train. She had agreed to take the train. Whenever he talks about the domestic abuse, he says that it was mutual, essentially. Like, he doesn't say it full out, but he'll say, like, a pushing, shoving argument.
Sure.
Or, like, yeah.
When he's definitely the aggressor.
Yeah. And, like, I didn't personally know Kathleen, obviously, but, like, I can't see her hitting someone back.
I mean, even if she did, if he's the aggressor.
Facts.
Self-defense.
Facts. It's funny you say something about self-defense. Well,
oh, no.
He said he wasn't worried until the school called him and said that she had not been in several days for her internship. Her family said that he shouldn't report it, so he held off until that Thursday.
Her family said that?
No, his.
Oh, of course they did.
He said at first the police didn't want to hear that she was missing, and Robert had to convince her that she was missing rather than she ran off.
Interesting.
The police never even ended up searching the house or the surrounding area for evidence.
What? Wow.
Also, there's a little wrinkle in Robert's story of that night. His neighbor, whom he said he had a drink with, says that never happened.
What?
Strip brushed this off. Later, literally like 20 plus years later, in an interview, and says that the neighbor could be the one that was wrong. So he didn't really look too far into that.
Okay, sure.
Which is funny because Durst admitted to the interview in this documentary that I'll mention later, that he made that whole story up because he thought he could make it go away. After he dropped her off, he just went home and went to sleep, and he never spoke to her that night.
What?
Oh, my son was out.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, he thought, like, if he gives himself pretty much, like, an alibi, it gets it off him.
Sure.
He wasn't wrong.
But you need someone to corroborate the alibi.
Well, that's why he gave the neighbor.
Yeah, because the neighbor didn't corroborate it.
They never asked the neighbor.
Oh, I thought you were saying that.
No.
Oh.
The interviewer for this documentary asked the neighbor.
Oh.
The police didn't do their job, so he was right.
Ask. Oh, my.
It took it off of him because they were inept.
Oh, God, they're idiots.
So Kathy's case goes cold. 20 years later, there was this guy, Timothy Martin, who was arrested for public lewdness, and before his sentencing, he shared some information. We don't find out what that information is.
Okay.
But because of this information, two detectives show up at Gabrielle Colquitt's house, which used to belong to the Dursts.
Okay.
They come in and look around, but they found absolutely nothing. They called out divers to search the lake. Nothing. Just nothing.
Interesting.
But all this reinvigorated the case and brought new eyes to it. So, the detectives begin to go back and interview people. And all of Kathy's friends say to investigators, you should talk to Susan Berman. She was a friend to Robert, And when Kathy went missing, she protected him from everything.
What?
They said if anyone knows about Robert's involvement, it's Susan. Oh, and her dad was a rich Las Vegas mobster.
Oh, God.
And, like, a funny story is that she found out her dad was a mobster when she was 21 because she read it in a book.
Fuck. What a way to find out. See, that's what I was going to ask you, too. Is there any way that since Robert Durst's family is so rich and everything, that they have a connection with, like, the cops, and that's why they didn't do their job?
Maybe, but just seeing how Struck talks about the whole thing, he seems like he couldn't give a shit less.
Yeah.
Back when Kathy first disappeared, police were not giving out details to the press. But a family spokesperson would go to the papers and share very important details, like the doorman of the apartment seeing her.
Interesting.
Robert admits to having Susan deal with the press, and she essentially became his spokesperson. So, basically, she is this family spokesman that was sharing all this stuff from the police.
Great.
So, remember that story that Kathy made to Manhattan? Mm-hmm. Many people, including the police, now doubt this. They believe she never made it onto that train. So, this means that someone had to have called her Dean, pretend to be Kathy, pretend to be sick.
Interesting.
Who would be a woman that could do that? Susan. And what about the doorman? We will come back to this. About this doorman.
Oh, God.
I also want to put here that the investigation was officially reopened October 31st, 2000.
Okay.
The next day, Robert bought an engagement ring for Deborah. Also, he signed over power of his attorney to Deborah. And they got married December that year. People think that everybody knows his secrets, but now that they're married,
she can't testify. Why would you marry a man if you know all those secrets? Why would you do that?
Because I'm different. I don't know, man.
I'm not like other girls. I love murderers.
Police in the second investigation think that he killed Kathy, put her in his trunk, and then went to Ship Bottom, which is a town in New Jersey by the coast.
Okay.
They believe this because Durst headquarters received 3 call collects. Collect calls?
Yeah. Collect calls.
From a laundromat in Ship Bottom that Tuesday. Oh. Only 2 people, according to Durst employees, ever used call collect. Robert and Seymour. Well, Seymour was out of town, so that leaves Robert. Robert confirms he did do call collects all the time, but he denies that he made the laundromat calls. He says that, like, several other people in the family and the organization made collect calls.
Really? Call name collect. One.
Seymour. Done.
Got him.
So, Ship Bottom is also the place where the mob is known to dump bodies.
Shit.
There are tons of places to bury bodies as well as the sea, like the coast.
Yeah.
Which connects Susan Berman, who was connected to the mob.
Yep. Oh my God.
Remember Ellen? She yet again was doing the police's work. She tracked Susan down, like her current address, and basically drew him out to her door, which she gave to police. And she said, whatever you do, interview this woman. She knows more than she's saying. And this would have been in November, around there, into
this
December.
This story kind of reminds me of Taylor Swift's song.
Nobody, no crime. On December 24th, 2000, West Los Angeles patrol officers respond to a report of an open door at 1527 Benedict Canyon Drive. The officers saw that the rear doors opened and entered the house and found a body laying on the floor in the southwest portion of the house. She had a single gunshot wound to the back of her head. This was Susan Berman, who was shot dead execution style.
Because she knew too much. Oh, no.
Detective Paul Coulter was on the scene and said that the house looked pretty empty. And all the furniture in the house was, like, loaned. There was no carpet on the concrete floors.
What?
And there was no heating, even.
Interesting.
There were no signs of forced entry.
So she knew them.
Also, I'm sure this is a complete coincidence, but police were going to interview her again in the coming days.
Oh, I'm sure they were.
Police in LA didn't think that Robert was a suspect, instead looked at her mob ties, since she was working on a TV show about the Las Vegas mob and said that she was going to share something huge.
Okay, but I thought her dad was part of the mob, right?
Well, yeah, but he died.
Oh.
So, like, he was dead.
Well, that's unfortunate.
The Beverly Hills police got a letter in the mail. It said Beverly Hills police in the front with Beverly spelled wrong.
Same.
B-E-V-E-R-L-E-Y. This is important. So listen up. This is important. Did you hear how I spelled Beverly?
B.
B E V E R L E Y.
Interesting.
It's not E Y, it's just Y.
Yeah.
And the note said 1527 Benedict Canyon cadaver. That's it. It was postmarked the day before the discovery of the victim. Someone wanted the police to find the body. They eliminated the mafia from suspects because of this note.
Yeah, because the mafia would not do that.
And essentially, they believed that whoever sent the note didn't want the body to just sit there and decompose.
Like Robert Durst, maybe.
And they came to the conclusion it's because they care about her, which means it's not the mob.
Like Robert Durst. Thank you. And good night.
Allegedly. On Susan's hard drive, they found a ledger of people she asked for money. Essentially.
What?
She was months behind in rent and was having a lot of money troubles.
Shit.
She was a failed writer, that's why.
Okay.
One of the names on the ledger was Bobby. Hmm. And she said that she had gotten $50,000 from this Bobby. Many friends of hers said that she was manipulative and even once said that they could see her using blackmail.
Okay, I was gonna fucking say.
So Robert never even went to her funeral. But he called and spoke to her friends, and one friend said that he asked about the investigation, and another friend said that she felt like he was trying to find allies in her group of friends.
Ah, interesting.
Back to Morris in Texas. Robert said that he had no idea what made him shoplift. He just went for it. Then, as you know, he was taken in, and he admits to trying to disguise himself, and he even shaved his eyebrows. But Sidney DeRio goes, so you purposefully shaved your eyebrows, and he goes, how do you shave your eyebrows off accidentally?
You got me there.
Robert is charged with Morris's murder, and Judge Susan Chris presided over the case. Robert had pleaded not guilty. The prosecution was strong, and everyone was wondering how in the hell the defense was going to get him off. They begun by humanizing him and showing the pictures that he had on him the day he was arrested. First, it was photos of his first girlfriend, which I don't know why he had that.
That was kind of weird.
Because that was not Kathy. Photos of Kathy. And childhood photos. The first witness called is actually Durst himself.
Interesting. I feel like they don't usually do that.
They first had to explain why Durst was running when he killed Morris. Like why he was hiding in Texas.
Okay.
He said on the stand that he wanted to go to Galveston disguised and never be Robert Durst again. There was a woman named Janine Pirro who was a Westchester County District Attorney. And defense says that she was the one trying to reopen Kathy's case for the sole purpose of trying to convict Robert, a big name, and further her political career.
Yeah, not because he killed her or anything.
They made her the enemy, and one of Robert's attorneys in the documentary said, quote, we kind of created this mythical character that's Janine Pirro. We took liberty with how directly she was involved with the pursuit of Bob.
Wow.
That's why he was trying to get out of New York, allegedly. That's what he says. Robert testified that he decided to disguise himself as a woman. He bought a wig and decided that he would have to be mute because the way you hear him, he's a very gruff, manly voice.
Okay.
He also later said he patted himself on the back and he was like, it was a great disguise.
Me.
So now he's in the apartment in Galveston. And Robert said that him and Morris became good friends. They said they fell into a routine of watching TV and then getting coffee, etc., etc.
Like, him as a woman or Robert?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
So after a little bit, Robert decided to stop wearing the disguises, and Morris knew that he was trying to hide, and like Morris understood it.
Okay.
And at this point, Morris knew who Robert was.
Okay.
Robert said that he had only one 9mm pistol, a revolver, and another pistol. Morris also liked guns. Because this comes back. And they both were target shooters. Like, for funsies. On the 17th of September, Robert says that Morris showed Robert his eviction notice. Morris's eviction notice. And that Robert went to the bathroom and heard a gunshot. And Robert comes out and tells Morris, put down the gun. Morris said that he just shot the eviction notice. So Robert was like, okay, get out of my apartment and do not come back. Because, like, dude was in his apartment and shot an eviction notice.
Yeah, that's weird.
They spun this story that Morris was a really violent guy and was prone to flying off the handle. On September 28th, Robert arrived home and he saw his TV was on. So Robert further opens the door and sees that Morris is sitting on the table, at his table,
mm-hmm.
at Robert's table in his apartment.
Interesting.
And he was angry at Robert. What happens is that Morris swiveled his chair towards Bob, and he had a gun, and he was just looking at him. Bob kept saying, just give me the gun. Robert goes for the gun, and they struggle for it. And at one point, the gun is in between their two chests. You know, like, their chest to chest, and the gun's in between, and they're, like, struggling for it. And Bob says that when they fell to the ground, as Robert's elbow hit the floor, the gun went off and shot Morris in the face.
Do we believe this?
We'll get there.
Okay.
The prosecution was like, no. They never went anywhere, and they could not find one person to confirm that they were friends or went anywhere. No one saw them go anywhere together.
Oh.
Prosecution made it clear that Morris knew Robert had money. And they said that they theorized that he found out the extent of who Robert was and started going to him for money, and may have even gone as far as to threaten to tell people in New York where Robert was.
Fair.
There were multiple giant bruises on Morris's shoulders. Robert doesn't know where the bruises came from, if not from the falling. Which, if you fall to the ground, no matter how you fall to the ground, how would it be on the top of your shoulders and shoulder blades? Prosecution says that there was multiple bruises that, like, happened at different times, and that you cannot get them all at one time, one moment. Robert's neighbor also says that she heard two gunshots, and Robert has no explanation for that. There's also a bullet hole in the wall, which you may assume is from Morris shooting the eviction letter, but there was a hole in the eviction letter. Prosecutors say that Robert tried shooting him, missed, beat him to the ground, and then killed him, execution style, to the back of the head. And they were also like, why dismember him if it's self-defense?
But also, he said that when they fell, he accidentally shot him. You can't fucking shoot someone execution style in the back of the head.
No. Prosecution is saying that he shot him execution style.
No, but that's what I'm saying. Like, him saying that is stupid because there's forensic ways to tell which way a bullet went in and came out.
If they have the head.
Oh, shit, they don't have the head. I forgot about that.
So Robert said that after killing him, he essentially realized that if he called the police, they would find out who he was. And people in New York already thought he was a murderer, so he thought that no one in Texas would believe him. I wonder why. He later said he had to get the corpse out of his apartment and that he was scared to death.
I was gonna say, sorry, dude, but so far you're 0-2. Like, your bodies are piling up on your watch. It's starting to look like you, bud.
He later said, he was gonna carry it or drag it, but he wasn't strong enough to carry it, and he felt dragging a body would be too ridiculous. Yeah. During his trial, he said he did dismember Morris. He admitted to that. He said he used Morris's tools and he bought bow saw and trash bags. He also said he continued to smoke more weed and drink more to the point of being drunk during this time.
God.
He says he remembered primarily using the axe, though. He put most of the body in garbage bags, except for the torso, which he put in a suitcase. He drove to a spot on the coast and threw all the body parts in, including the head. What Robert did not understand is that the bags were going to float, and he had no idea what the tide was like. He didn't know if it was high tide, low tide, coming in, coming out. So the bags float, and he became scared. People were going to find the body. So he took the head from one of the bags. Investigators think that he took the head not because of DNA or identification purposes. Instead, they think he took the head because it would show exactly how he was murdered. Yep. They think that there was no struggle. Instead, Robert just pinned him down and shot him in the back of the head, which would be obvious to see on the head.
Mm-hmm. And if he struggled to get him onto the ground, onto his stomach to shoot him in the back of the head, that would explain why he has bruises on his back, like on his shoulder blades.
Mm-hmm. The defense was emphatic that it did not matter what Robert did to the body after he died. The trial was solely on how Morris died, since there was no charges brought against Robert of dismemberment or destruction of evidence, which is true. This was solely murder.
Why?
I don't know.
That's stupid.
In cases of self-defense, the prosecution has to prove it was not self-defense, and they couldn't do it. At one point, my boy Gonzalez was on the stand and was asked point blank, did you find any evidence to disprove self-defense? And he was honest, and he said no. The trial lasted 6 weeks, and the verdict comes back from the jury. We, the jury, have found Robert Durst not guilty. One person on the jury came out later and said that the whole deliberation, during the whole deliberation, there was never more than 3 people at a time that thought Robert was guilty.
What?
On December 21st, 2004, he had another trial. This time, he pled guilty to bail jumping and evidence tampering for the dismemberment of the body. His guilty plea was part of a plea bargain which got him 5 years in prison, but with time served, he only spent 3 years in jail.
My God!
After Robert was declared not guilty, this further relit the fire underneath Pierrot's ass. Because, like, if he had gone to jail, at least she could be like, okay, a murderer's away.
Yeah.
But now she's like, well, shit. All right. So they all tried to crack the family again, Robert's family.
Mm-hmm.
Something weird is that there was not a single interview that was done with any member of the Durst family during the original investigation. Not what? One with one member of the family.
What? Does that make any sense?
You would think that they would ask a multimillionaire what he thinks happened to his daughter-in-law, no?
Yep.
Robert said that his dad really didn't engage with the investigation or ask him anything about it or anything like that.
Yeah, that's not weird at all.
After 10 or 11 weeks, the original detectives got a call from a man named Nick Scapetta, and he said that Bob was really satisfied by their work. But Robert is very busy, so any communications should now go through him, since that was his lawyer.
Okay.
Robert says that that was his lawyer, and he was also supposed to find Kathy, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Nick brought in a PI, Ed Wright, to find her. Ed Wright was a police officer and was able to get information from the police that the average person would not.
Okay.
So Wright technically worked for Scapetta, not Robert.
Okay.
And Scapetta was hired by the Durst family, not Robert directly.
Interesting. Okay.
Wright had a confidential form that the documentarians got their hands on that lists the discrepancies in Robert's story. Bob had, for one, changed where he said he made the phone call to Kathleen, which we know the whole story was a lie anyways, but on February 13th, he said he called from the house, then on the 28th, he said he called Kathleen from a restaurant, then he changed it to a payphone, etc. The police spoke to the doorman, who said he saw her, but in an interview with Wright, that same doorman said that she never came into the building. Eventually, both Wright and the Dursts decided it would be best if they went their separate ways.
Wow.
Probably because it was looking like Robert was guilty.
Yep. It was looking like she was dead.
And overall, Robert had around 10 or 12 meetings with Wright, and Douglas was actually there for 5 or 6 of them.
Interesting.
So that could also lead to why he was afraid of Robert
mm-hmm.
and hired like the security and everything. Jeanine Pierrot interviewed Debbie. Weirdly enough, Debbie couldn't recall where Robert was around Christmas time of 2000, aka when Susan was murdered. This is her newlywed husband.
And she doesn't know where he is.
This is weeks after they were married.
What?
Didn't know where he was. Detective Paul Coulter says that he cannot place Bob specifically in LA at the time, but he can place him in California. Also, 2 people said that Susan had said that Robert was coming to visit and that she was really excited. From the 19th to the 23rd, it was hard to track Bob. They know he got his car out of the parking lot at an airport, and he made a call in Garberville, which is around 80 to 90 miles south of his car.
Hmm.
This was on the 19th, that he got his car out of the parking lot.
Okay.
And he next showed up on the 23rd when he purchased a flight out of San Francisco. Her body was found the next day.
Hmm.
The autopsy said that she had been dead for around 24 hours when she was found. After the investigation, they had released Susan's belongings to her son.
Okay.
And among these possessions were audio tapes and a letter. A letter from Robert to Susan Berman. Susan Berman, 1527 Benedict Canyon at Beverly, Beverley Hills, California. And the handwriting is shockingly similar.
Oh my God. Oh wow. Yeah, it looks basically the same.
Now, what the filmmakers did here is actually quite interesting. At this point, no one really knew about this letter that her son had gotten. So they held on to it for a little bit until they could interview Bob again. They wanted his raw reaction. So they go to this guy, John Osborne, who's a forensic document examiner, and they had collected over 40 samples of Robert's writing as well as the letters for him to examine. He found them to be, and this isn't any paraphrasing, but they were pretty fucking similar. And he said they were distinctive to one person.
Wow.
Bob. So they all have their ducks in a row to interview him again. But that's when Bob starts ghosting them.
Of course.
Pushing off dates, not answering calls, falling off the map, until he gets arrested again in New York.
Of course.
Douglas had gotten an order of protection against Bob, which Bob broke by visiting Doug's house.
Oh my
god. Which was all on camera.
What an idiot.
And he needed the documentarians to, like, provide evidence of, like, why he was going to Douglas's. Because at one point, for the film, they had gone to the Durst business building.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Douglas's case was like, see, he's following me. Blah, blah, blah. But the documentarians were like, oh, we were just doing it for the movie, whatever. Mm-hmm. But this gave them, they had leverage. Because of this, they had leverage over Robert, and now he was ready to talk again. So the plan is to first give the letter inside the envelope found at Susan's house. It was like a nothing letter. It wasn't like suspicious or anything.
Okay.
So likely he would admit that he wrote that letter.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would introduce the envelope and see his reaction. The day of the interview, they begin the plan. He admits the letter came from his office, but he can't remember specifically writing that letter, but he doesn't deny that he wrote it. He's just like, I don't remember specifically writing that one. They pull out the envelope and he says Beverly spelled wrong. Like he says it to himself. And goes past that, just like right by it.
Okay.
And starts talking about the zip code.
Just random.
You know old people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just going on with their nonsense, on their bullshit, you know. So the filmmaker brings up the cadaver note. And he says that, oh shit, there's the same spelling. And he even says himself that the writing does look similar. He says he did not write the cadaver note. So the filmmaker goes, okay, which one did you write? He has the two letters in front of him. And he goes, okay, I wrote this one, which is the letter to Susan, the nothing note.
Okay.
Then he goes, okay, so which one did you not write? And he points to the cadaver note. And then he brings the photo that I just showed you, which I will post. And he goes, which one did you not write? He goes, I don't know. Like, he can't point out which one he didn't write. The interview ends, and before he leaves, he goes to the bathroom while still mic'd, and this happens.
There it is. Your cord. You're right, of course. But you can't imagine. What's in the house? Oh, I want this. I insist.
Okay, dude's not right. If you can hear the end there, he goes, killed them all, of course. And he's fucking talking to himself. Holy shit. You should definitely post that video on the Instagram. Oh my god.
I think I'll get hit by copyright.
Just change it a little bit.
I'll do the voiceover.
Yeah.
A dramatic reenactment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is actually where the documentary ends. But I can't leave you there. So here's what happens after. On March 14th, 2015, Durst is arrested for the murder of Susan Berman. When he was arrested, he had 5 ounces of marijuana, his passport, and birth certificate.
Oh, so someone's ready to leave.
Maps of Louisiana, Florida, and Cuba. A latex flesh-toned mask.
Well, okay.
He thinks he's a master disguise.
You can't make this shit up.
A Texas ID, a cell phone, and $42,631 in.
That is interesting.
Until 2019, there were a lot of like court things happening, including firearms charges, pretrial hearings, and his team was trying to postpone this shit, mistrials, shit like that. Mm-hmm. The next biggest thing I want to talk about, though, is on December 24th, 2019, Durst's lawyers admit that he wrote the cadaver note.
What?
Susan's trial officially began March 2nd, 2020, which was cut short in June 2020 because of COVID. So, damn. As of now, the trial should pick back up May 17th, 2021. So, very soon. And that's where we are right now.
How did they admit that? Just, oh, by the way, he wrote that. It's fine.
There are also two things I wanted to tell you that I didn't know really where to, like, put them.
Okay.
He had 7 malamutes that all died under unknown circumstances. They were 7 separate dogs, like, he got them at separate times.
I think we know.
And they were all named Igor.
What?
No Igor lasted more than 6 months. Oh, and he said at one point on a recorded jail phone call that he wanted to, quote, Igor his brother.
This man was killing his fucking dogs.
Yep. And also, this is gonna make you laugh. He told prosecutors he was on meth during the documentary.
Yeah, that just cleans up all your problems.
No, I was on meth.
I mean, I'm gonna be honest, that explains him talking to himself a little bit.
And dumbass, okay? So early in the documentary, during his first interview, he was still mic'd and he started talking to himself too. And his lawyer was like, stop it, your mic is still on. He was like, oh, that's fine.
And then he doesn't get in the bathroom.
If I'm completely honest, this dude's gonna die soon.
Why? How old is he?
Well, it's not just that. He had, like, esophageal cancer. He had to get surgeries and stuff. Like, this dude, he's looking rough. Hold on.
Oh. Because I want to know how, like, convincing
he was. This is when he was arrested.
Jeez. He's looking real old. How old is he, you know? Off the top of your head? Is it easy to look up that video of him talking to himself?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe. Are you going to link it?
I can.
Okay. Oh, wow. Ooh, damn. Yeah, that man looks like he's on death's door.
Yeah. I wish there was photos of him dressed as a woman. He's currently 78.
He looks every bit of 78.
So the documentary I was talking about was The Jinx, Robert Durst. I watched on HBO.
Okay.
What
an idiot.
Yep, what a man. Call me salt and pepper, because what a man.
Oh my god.
So, I definitely think he did. And here's the thing. I think he didn't dispose of Susan in, like, a lake or anything. Because he cared more about her.
Yeah, but if she started blackmailing him, he kind of, like, had to, even though he cared about her, I feel like, so...
Also, people were speculating that people think that he was practicing on his Malamutes how to get rid of the body.
Great. I love that for us. God, that's awful. And he names them all Igor. Oh my fucking god.
Like, people wouldn't notice.
Yeah.
That he had many Igors.
And that they weren't aging.
But then saying he wants to Igor his brother on a prison call. Fucked.
He's an idiot. I still can't get over him talking to himself in the bathroom. Killed them all, of course. Like, of course. What a fucking idiot.
And it was a really interesting part of the documentary was talking to his lawyers about, like, their strategies and what he was told to do on the stand. And how essentially, you know how they are, like, tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And he was like, he said he was told to just focus on the first and last part. So you could just leave stuff out. And for example, he would say, I don't remember a lot, if something would make him sound bad or dehumanize him. So for example, the prosecution could say something like, how did you kill them? Okay. How long was it? Where did you start? What tool did you use? So it's focusing on the fact that he's dismembering the body. He puts that picture in your head.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of even going down that train of thought, he'll just go, I don't remember. I don't recall.
I do not recall.
I do not recall.
Pulled the Justin Bieber. I do not recall.
So it was very interesting.
Why was Justin Bieber deposed? I'm sorry, that's off track, but I don't remember what it was for.
Drag racing, I believe. Okay. And not the fun kind.
Fucks.
RuPaul was not there.
Yeah, no. He was not involved.
So any final thoughts on Durst?
It's fucking crazy.
But yeah, during his last interview when they were talking about the cadaver note, he was just burping the whole time. And apparently he burps and farts a lot. Like, all the time.
Is he okay?
No. Also, they were like, why would he use the word cadaver? And people are thinking it's because his first wife, Kathy, was in medical school. And she would always talk about, like, the cadaver she used.
Oh, interesting.
Because, like, she couldn't give them names who she was working on. Because, like, then you would get too close. So she would just call them, like, my cadaver.
Yeah. See, I was thinking something along those lines. Like, he called it a cadaver because, like, it separates him from Susan.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like, fuck,
he
fucking
did it. That man's out of his fucking mind.
Mm-hmm. And there was that one point where the defense was talking about how, like, he talked about how he dressed up as a woman and he bought a wig and the jury laughed. And he was like, essentially, well, we won in humanizing him. They laughed. Which is true. Oh, they were seeing him as this, like, humorous figure.
I didn't realize that wearing a wig was funny. I'm pretty sure that people do it all the time.
I have to admit, it's a little funny. Just the way he said it. The fact he had to be a mute woman because of his voice. Well, you heard his voice. He you can't hide that.
Okay. So today, I'm talking about the Instagram account, TrendMood1. So basically, they started off with having, like, spoilers, I guess. Like, they would, like, find out spoilers from different, like, makeup companies and, like, release them on their Instagram. Now they've more evolved into, like, companies pay them to, like, you know,
leak
them. Yeah. Which, you're talking about it on Reddit, and, like, I just followed them, so I didn't realize that that's how they started out, so I was, like, shook.
You didn't know about TrendMood?
Not until recently.
Oh.
Yeah. So I was reading about that on Reddit, and then they were also saying, which I'm not surprised, but that since brands do pay them for that kind of stuff, they'll do things like remove negative comments. Yep, so specifically for, like, Kylie's new skincare line she's coming out with. Of course, there's tons of negative comments.
Yeah.
Nope, removed.
Her face is so filled, it probably doesn't even have pores anymore.
Like, it's just...
Don't buy Kylie skincare. I'll tell you this right now.
It's
true. She released a walnut scrub. That is really bad for your skin.
Oh, yeah. Do not use anything like that on your skin. It's too abrasive for your face. Okay. So the first thing that I will be talking about, though.
That's on their page.
Yes. Is the iHeart Revolution Disney collab. It's the Little Mermaid. So here's a picture.
Okay.
See, I think it's real cute.
I think that the eyeshadow palette could have been...
See, it's an eyeshadow palette, and it's, like, a face palette.
I know. I just think the colors could have been arranged better.
That'll give you. Like, some of the colors could have been better.
Put, like, the blues.
Together,
for
yeah,
example.
I agree. But, like, the names are cute. I mean, they have, like, a seaweed. They have flounder, mermaid, triton, flotsam, you know, Eric. I don't know why Eric is pink, but that's fine.
I feel like... It could have been better. It could have been stronger. They could have had her sisters, for example, be shade names. And you know how they have, like, a main color that's, like, their tail and everything?
Mm-hmm.
Could have had that for them. But no. Basic.
And then Ursula. Please tell me why they made Ursula, like, a fuchsia color instead of black.
Or dark purple, like an aubergine.
Literally.
A gray, even, like, her hair.
Yeah, no, purple.
The outside is very pretty.
Yeah, I like it a lot. And I love the highlighter.
The outside looks like a storybook.
Yeah, like, I just think it's so cute. 8 out of 10. That's all I'm giving it. Would buy. I don't even know. Oh, okay, the prices are here. So the eyeshadow palette, which is also, I think, like, a face palette kind of, is $20. And then the highlighters are 10, and then the lip topper is 7.
Those prices.
Not bad. I don't think.
I don't think they're bad, but $10 for a highlighter when the eyeshadow palette is 20?
Yeah. Okay, that's fair.
And then a lip gloss is $7 when a highlighter is 10.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah, cheap, pretty cheap.
Cute.
I wouldn't buy it, but that's more I wouldn't use it.
Fair enough.
Where was the next one I was looking at?
Oh, I thought these were cool. It is the Daycation Whipped Cream Blush by Bite. I more like the containers. I thought they were cute. No, just me.
I feel like it'd be such a pain in the ass to squeeze out the right amount.
The only thing also is $32.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no thank you. No thanks. Especially because you're not really getting that much product, it looks like.
Those literally just look like a fancier version of the ColourPop ones.
What she's referring to is the new Too Faced blushes called Love Flush. Like, they're cute, they're heart-shaped, but, like, they're nothing special.
They look like the ColourPop ones, but the pan is embossed with Too Faced and it has little bunnies on it. Mm-hmm. I think those are very cute.
Yeah, I think they're cute.
I would buy them. I don't think they're really blush colors.
The bottom two are, but the top three, who would they work on?
I have no idea.
Yeah, that I'm a fan. The other thing I was going to talk about are the new ColourPop Shock Shadows.
Super Shock Shadows.
They are so, so pretty. I will go through the list of names for them. There is 9 new ones. There's Ladybug, Sweet Tea, Moon Daisy, Chirp, Fruit Punch, You're My Sunshine, Heads Up, Secret Garden, and Rosebud. I don't know. They're all just so pretty. Like, some of them I would not use. Like, the green, I probably would never use. But I love.
Why don't you describe the colors?
I will try my best. Rosebud is, like, brown with gold shimmers in it.
Mm-hmm.
You would agree? Secret Garden is more of, what, like, an orangey kind of brown with pink shimmer?
Like a caramel color.
Okay. Heads Up is, like, a red, I guess, with shimmer in it.
It's like an orangey red. Okay. A blood orange, if you will.
It's fucking red. You're My Sunshine is pink with, it looks like maybe blue glitter in it.
Perhaps purple.
Fruit Punch. I don't get these color names.
It is not Fruit Punch colored.
No, it's just like a gold. Well, a little more leaning yellow, but
that's
like.
That's a neon green.
Yeah, and it doesn't look green. I'm going to tell you that right now. I think it looks green. Maybe I'm blind. I don't know.
Like a green gold.
Maybe. But like the You're My Sunshine, see that one should have been You're My Sunshine, in my opinion, the way that it's swatched.
Yeah.
You're My Sunshine being like a hot pink. That doesn't make any sense. And then Chirp is like a peach color with gold flecks in it. Moon Daisy is like a bluish?
A gray blue, I would say.
And then Sweet Tea is like a pink with like flecks in it.
But the base doesn't look as pigmented. Like with Moon Daisy and Sweet Tea, it doesn't look as pigmented. The base,
yeah,
a shade like You're My Sunshine.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And then Ladybug is just like, what?
Brownish?
Something like that.
It's undescript.
But yeah.
I'd get Moon Daisy just because I haven't really seen anything like it.
I like Moon Daisy and I really like You're My Sunshine.
I think it would look nice on you. It's in your wheelhouse.
Wow. And those are only going to be, I want to say they said $5.
There was each. A sale that all the Super Shock Shadows were $5. I don't know if it's still going on. You should check.
Oh, yes. And then this is kind of random. It's not really like makeup or anything, but there's candles from Forever Mood.
Holy shit.
They're $38, but they're beautiful. I love the packaging. It's 4 candles, 10 ounces. Supposedly 65-hour burn time, $38 each. There's Bad and Boozy, which is apple, jasmine, and oak moss. Butterfly Effect, which is rose, violet, sandalwood. Cloud Dream, which is strawberry, lychee, and vanilla bean. And then Spring Flings, which is coconut, white peach, and musk. And it says,
I'm sorry. But who's like, you know what I want in a candle?
Musk. I know, I was thinking that too.
When I hear musk, I think of the smell of like ferrets.
Me too. Like, they're so pretty. I love them. Which one? Oh, yeah, that's the next one I was going to talk about. So they're body milks. They're called Floral Body Milks by Fourth Ray Beauty, which I hadn't heard of before. They have lavender, peony, and rose, and they just look like they smell good. Does that make sense? They're just really cute packaging.
It's another thing with the name. I don't like milk. Also, it really looks like this is very personal. It looks like my ColourPop primer that I use. It's orange and it's really sticky.
Oh.
It looks like the same kind of consistency. So if I don't know, I feel like they would be sticky. I have literally nothing to prove that though. But like a milk. A skin milk?
A body milk?
A milk?
A milk? I don't want to say it like that, but... Of course, there's going to be a new Natasha Denona palette.
That no one wants. It's boring.
For $65.
Snoozing over here. She's like, I'm going to put some more warm-tone browns, but some blues.
Yep.
Every fucking palette. Do something new, Natasha!
It's so boring. Oh, yeah, and then I haven't heard of Hip Dot either. Mm-hmm. They're doing a Clueless collab. Very 90s, Clueless, very cute. It has like the plaid for the tops of the
for the lid.
Yeah, for the lip gloss stick.
Lip gloss.
Yeah.
The eyeshadow palette, the top is fuzzy. I don't like the colors in it.
No, I'm not a huge fan.
They don't scream Clueless to me. They're just kind of basic.
Yeah. I love the packaging. I think it's really cute.
It's all pastel pink and everything.
There was one that I was looking for on there. I'm going to try and find it because... Oh, I think I sent it to you because I thought it was just bullshit. Oh, here it is. Urban Decay. I haven't actually seen it yet. I don't think they've released the actual collaboration. They're doing a collaboration with Prince.
You know, the guy.
The guy who's
fucking dead.
Like, I don't know how that works, if they do it with, like, his estate or what, but it just seems weird.
Yeah, I don't like when someone dies and...
They try and, like, profit off of it. It seems icky to me.
It's dropping May 27th, 2021.
Thank you.
It looks like people are speculating it's going to be Purple E, which... Wow, how original. Prince Clap is purple.
If it's not, I'm going to be like, what is wrong with you?
I don't know. I feel like there's so much that you could do with Prince.
Yeah.
He's just such an icon visually. Mm-hmm. Like, not even talking about his music.
100%.
Which you could go into his music, but just visually that it has to be so over the top, so epic, but like,
yeah.
Also kind of like elegant.
Yes, exactly. I don't think they're going to achieve that.
No, they're not nearly interesting enough.
And people online were saying that like recently Urban Decay stuff has been shit, which I wouldn't know. I haven't really used them in a while.
My last Urban Decay product was probably the Naked palette when it first came out.
Oh my god.
But I don't think they'll be able to do it. They're not creative enough.
No, I just don't think so.
And like,
it would take a special kind of brand.
That, and I feel like you would have to have a special kind of passion for Prince. And like,
yes.
Urban Decay as a brand, do you think they really give a shit about Prince?
I really don't think so.
I would trust it more if it was like an indie brand, because then you can think like, oh, that brand owner,
they really like Prince. Yeah, they're not trying to just profit off of him.
Which, like, also it comes back to like, who's your demographic?
Well, exactly, because Prince is more for older generations, like our parents.
Yeah, and it's like, we of course we know Prince, but like, would we buy that kind of palette just because it's Prince?
Exactly.
I mean,
wouldn't. I'm sure there are like a couple younger people, but.
Yeah, a few that are like, I was born in the wrong generation.
Me.
But it's not like, this is so stupid, but like a SpongeBob collab that so many people our age would buy.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we have that kind of like, I don't want to say a deep connection to fucking SpongeBob.
No,
it's
like that nostalgia feeling.
Yeah.
That's what I also like the Lizzie McGuire palette, things like that. You have to have like some kind of nostalgia to want to buy it.
Just tie.
Yeah.
It's like... Who and like old people or older people, I can't see them buying a palette either just because
it's
of a name attached to it.
Yeah,
I don't know. Who is this for? Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
But I'm telling you, if it's just a full purple palette, I'm gonna be so disappointed.
Yeah,
because there is so much to work with.
Yeah, there's Prince. So much more to do.
How long was he a musician?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, come on,
Maria, over.
It's like making a Michael Jackson palette and then being like, Thriller.
Oh, God.
Right, guys? Am I right? Right?
I don't know. It just feels weird, them profiting off of somebody who's dead.
Even if it's an estate. Fuck the estate. Like, if he really wanted to do an Urban Decay collab, I'm sure he would have had time to.
Alive.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Apparently, we're going to have to start writing into our wills. I do not want to do any makeup collab posthumously.
Yeah, because someone's going to do that for us.
I mean, if you didn't at least try, I'd be a little
offended. Oh, my God.
If you didn't try to make some money off of my death, I would be so disappointed.
Jesus.
Also, like, the state doesn't have enough money. Come on. Also, okay, this is throwing me into a rant. I hate when people are like, it's for the fans. Are you making money from it? Are you making money from it? Then it's not just for the fans. Thank you.
Unless they were going to take the money and donate it to his charity or something. Like a charity that he, like, supported, but...
You think Urban Decay is going to flop through that?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, they're clearly just trying to profit off of it.
Nobody buy the palette, thank you.
Thank you, good night. I mean, if you're a really big fan of Prince, like, I get it, but I think it's kind of icky.
Put on one of his records. Curl your hair.
No, just me.
You know, I'm not familiar with that Prince song.
Oh my God.
All right.
Well, it's been real. It's been fun, but it has been real fun.
We're recording this on Mother's Day, so happy late Mother's Day.
Yes, bye. Mothers out there. Wow.
I'm a cat mom personally. Just put that
Christ.
Out there.
Okay, all right. So if you like to leave us a review, please do. Ah, yes, this is what I was going to say. If for some reason you want a shout out, email us. That's all you gotta do. Email us at beautifulbutdeadlypodcast@gmail.com and we'll give you a shout out next time.
You can follow us on Twitter @deadly_pod, but someone isn't posting to Twitter.
I'll try and do it more.
Instagram.
@beautifulbutdeadlypod. _? You'll find us. You'll figure it out.
Yeah. You're smart. You're loyal and I appreciate that. Bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Oh wait, leave a review. That's another thing.
I think I said that. Did I say that?
Did we say that? I don't think
so. No. That's fine.
Okay,
it's fine.
Bye.